It is Wednesday, June 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump boasts about Republican victories in special congressional elections. We look at the dispute between Qatar and four other Middle Eastern countries.
There never is just a single factor that causes governments to take new positions.
And London-based singer Dua Lipa releases a new single, and we'll listen to it. It's all ahead. U.S. President Donald Trump boasted on Twitter Wednesday about Republican success in winning congressional elections this year. The latest took place in Georgia, in what was the most expensive race for a seat in the House of Representatives in U.S. history. Republicans have won four races, with Democrats capturing a fifth seat. Karen Handel, a former Georgia state official, won Tuesday's marquee election in the wealthy, highly educated suburbs of Atlanta, Georgia, defeating her Democratic challenger, John Ossoff. The race was a major focus for both parties and sparked $50 million in campaign spending. A second Republican, Ralph Norman, won a congressional seat in South Carolina. I spoke with Jeffrey Skelly, political analyst at the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville.
Honestly, the Georgia 6th is sort of a difficult district to read. It was a district that saw a very sharp shift in terms of its partisan leaning, at least based on presidential vote, from the 2012 numbers to the 2016 numbers. I mean, we're talking about a district that Mitt Romney won by 23 points. So it's traditionally been a very Republican district. Newt Gingrich held this seat for a very long time. And then Donald Trump only won it by a point and a half in 2016. And that's probably because it's one of the most highly educated districts in the country. It's very affluent. It's very an area. It's the sort of area where Trump did much worse than Republicans have traditionally done. So that sharp shift makes it a district that's difficult to read because, you know, was it to some extent returning a little bit to its Republican roots? Karen Handel won by about 4 points in the end. Or are we sort of, is it sort of in a new frontier? And so everyone's been sort of trying to figure that out, but it's honestly difficult to say. We've had five special elections, four that actually involved a Democrat and a Republican facing off. And that's just a pretty small sample size to actually really get a read on things. And basically all these districts, you know, the individuals that were picked for Donald Trump's cabinet all came from districts that were at the very least Republican-leaning. The Georgia 6th was the only one that even had the potential to be competitive, really. Now, obviously, a few of the districts in question have, you know, such as ones in Kansas and South Carolina, have ended up with really close elections, but they, you know, it was always going to be really tough for a Democrat to get over the top. And so I guess my overall look at this is that the Georgia 6th was by far the best pickup opportunity for Democrats, but Republicans held on to it. I think Republicans should be at least slightly reassured that they held on. But I think if we're looking ahead to 2018, it's tough to say that this result really says anything substantial about that.
And I think the Republicans were quite critical of the Democratic challenger, John Ossoff, you know, painting him as very liberal, and I guess with not maybe that many real ties to the district.
Well, I mean, he was from that area. I think that one of the main criticisms was that he didn't actually live in the district, though that's a criticism that is interesting just because there are a few members of Congress who don't live in their districts. There's no constitutional requirement regarding that. But it definitely was something that may have worked against Ossoff at least a little bit. You know, he's 30 years old, very young. These were attacks that Handel's side delivered against Ossoff. And so, you know, I think to some degree it was going to be tough, but I think Democrats are at least a little disappointed because in the end, Ossoff basically won the same percentage in the initial primary, 48%, which was an open primary where all candidates ran at the same time. And then he won 48% in the runoff, what essentially was the general election against Handel. So perhaps that served as a little bit of a ceiling, at least in a district that, even despite the very sharp shift toward Democrats and at the presidential level, you know, is still more Republican leaning than not.
So this is all happening as, of course, I think you can say, or anybody can say, President Trump has been a very controversial president. He has, you know, supporters and those, though, that do not like him. But meanwhile, I guess the Republicans, you know, how much, I guess people vote in their districts more for their, maybe their local concerns than they do with the national government?
Well, I mean, I think the national environment is very important. Look, politics today is extremely nationalized. You can look at, you know, recent primaries, you know, like the Virginia Democratic primary for governor and see, you know, all kinds of talk about Donald Trump. So Donald Trump was very important to this. The only reason that this was probably that competitive, if you look at the district historically, is that Donald Trump is president. So I think he was very important to the closeness of this race, the fact that it was even on the map. I mean, look, it had been a district that Mitt Romney won by 23 points. The fact that Donald Trump was running for president and only won it by a point and a half and then now is president was certainly a factor, because otherwise this district, you know, if some more, you know, more typical or more, you know, classic Republican had been the presidential nominee in 2016, perhaps this district would not have swung as much as it did toward the Democrats.
Jeffrey Skelly, political analyst at the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
A lot of talk about that special election in Georgia in particular last night. It was the most expensive House race ever in the country, over $50 million spent. So a lot of attention on that, including from President Trump. He tweeted yesterday morning about Karen Handel endorsing her, supporting her, and tweeted against the Democrat John Ossoff. And then we have him last night, after the results come out, writing that the special elections are over and those who want to make America great again are 5-0, referring to the 5 congressional special elections all won by Republicans. He said all the fake news and all the money spent didn't do anything. But then he sent out a tweet later that said Democrats would do much better as a party if they got together with Republicans on health care, tax cuts, and security. Obstruction doesn't work. So some people saying that might signal some ways that he might want to compromise. However, a lot of Democrats are saying, of course, he just wants us to fall in line with whatever he's saying. So a little back and forth about that. A lot of political attention also on Jay Johnson. He's the former Secretary of Homeland Security, testifying on Capitol Hill today. And a lot of his lines getting attention on social media, particularly that the scale and scope of Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election was unprecedented, but also that there was no evidence of Russia tampering with votes, hacking into precincts to change voting machines, anything like that. So a lot of Trump supporters in particular saying, well, this settles it. The election wasn't altered in terms of the vote total by anything that Russia did. President Trump won this fair and square. But others, again, saying not so fast. The fact that there was interference means that it wasn't necessarily legitimate election, or at least wasn't wholly decided by the American people without the interference of Russia. So that conversation and that back and forth is going to continue unabated on social media, probably for months, if not years, until it finally gets settled, if it ever does. But regardless of what side of the political aisle you are on, we can all celebrate this. It is National Selfie Day. So people celebrating with all things selfie on social media, people taking a lot of selfies on social media, photos of celebrities taking selfies, photoshopped works of arts or historical scenes with selfies, selfie, anything you can imagine is on social media. But there are the selfie haters out there who are saying that selfies are dumb, they shouldn't be such a big cultural phenomenon, and most importantly, ban the selfie stick. People think it's dumb and dangerous. You could walk into a wall or poke somebody with it. So lots of talk about selfies today.
All about selfies. Well, thanks, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The ex-Homeland Security chief says Russian meddling did not affect the election vote count in 2016. The Taliban releases a new video of U.S. and Australian hostages. The FBI says a gunman who attacked Republican lawmakers acted alone. And the chief of the UN calls for protection of civilians in Raqqa. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. Scientists have discovered about 4,500 planets orbiting stars beyond our solar system since the mid-1990s. Now, a new international study led by researchers at the California Institute of Technology suggests that most planets found in the galaxy so far fall into two types. Most planets found in the Milky Way galaxy are either rocky planets that are up to nearly two times the size of Earth, or are gas-covered worlds between 2 to 3.5 times the size of Earth, but are smaller than Neptune. Among the discoveries made by NASA's Kepler spacecraft, the scientists say nearly every star has at least one planet larger than Earth but smaller than Neptune. Ironically, in our own solar system, the scientists say there aren't any planets that are sized between Earth and Neptune. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the King of Saudi Arabia elevates his son to crown prince. The United States has questioned grievances behind the two-week-old dispute between Qatar and four other countries that led to the diplomatic break in relations by Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt with Doha. Referring to the Regional Gulf Cooperation Council, State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert said, Washington has made numerous phone calls to Saudi, Qatari, Kuwaiti, Bahraini, Omani, and UAE officials.
Now that it's been more than 2 weeks since the embargo started, we are mystified that the Gulf states have not released to the public, nor to the Qataris, the details about the claims that they are making toward Qatar. The more the time goes by, the more doubt is raised about the actions taken by Saudi Arabia and the UAE. At this point, we are left with one simple question. Were the actions really about their concerns regarding Qatar's alleged support for terrorism, or were they about the long simmering grievances between and among the GCC countries?
Saudi Arabia said the June 5th break in relations, coupled with the trade and travel boycott, was prompted by Qatar's persistent support of terrorism, a charge Doha denies. Former ambassador and Middle East Institute scholar David Mack tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the State Department's comments reflect a distancing from President Donald Trump, who 2 weeks ago accused Doha of funding terrorism at a high level.
I think we all recognize that there never is just a single factor that causes governments to take new positions. There's always a balancing of various factors. It is the case that there are long-standing competitions and rivalries among the different GCC states. Normally, they deal with these in private. They don't become exercises in public the way this last one has been. This is not by any means the first time that there has been considerable friction between Saudi Arabia in particular and Qatar. But it is perhaps the first time that it has been so public and has caused such a high level of concern on the part of people who do see a value in political unity of the GCC.
Is the U.S. expressing either irritation or concern that this dispute be resolved?
The United States has a great interest in seeing that the dispute is resolved, and for that matter, so do the parties involved. The GCC states are in a dangerous part of the world. They are strongest when they at least have a certain amount of political unity to avoid being played off against one another by outside forces, whether those outside forces are external to the region or neighbor states like Iran. The United States has never depended upon the GCC as a collectivity, as a military alliance. It's nothing like NATO. And we've never depended upon the GCC as an economic union like the European Union. We have strong bilateral relations with all of these countries. Those bilateral relations are in most respects quite complementary. And we've seen recently that the United States is continuing its very robust military engagement with Qatar, even while it does this very same thing with Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and other GCC states.
Former ambassador and Middle East Institute scholar David Mack. The appointment of Saudi King Salman's son, Mohammed bin Salman, to be the new crown prince, replacing his cousin, Mohammed bin Nayef, had long been rumored, but may have been precipitated by acute regional tensions, including the war in Yemen, the intensifying regional struggle with Iran, and the recent crisis with Qatar. As the torchbearer for a new generation, the new crown prince is reputed to have a more modern, less traditional outlook on governing the kingdom, as Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Hello.
Saudi media showed newly appointed Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman receiving a pledge of loyalty from his predecessor, Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, his older cousin, early Wednesday morning. The fealty ceremony, which is symbolic in a traditionally tribal society, took place at the Safa Palace in Mecca. The new crown prince already wielded enormous power as the country's defense minister and as his father's right-hand man. Mohammed bin Salman is also heavily involved in economic policy and launched an ambitious plan earlier this year to transform the kingdom's economy called Horizon 2030. He was also thought to be instrumental in the partial privatization of the country's flagship national oil company, Aramco. Perhaps Mohammed bin Salman's most significant enterprise, however, has been the kingdom's war effort in Yemen. Riyadh has been attempting to dislodge the Iranian-backed Houthi militia from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, and to restore the internationally recognized president, Abdrabu Mansour Hadi. That effort has proven to be extremely costly and drawn some degree of cross-border retaliation. Riyad Khawaji, who heads the Dubai-based Institute for Near East and Gulf Military Analysis, tells VOA that observers in the Gulf are expecting Mohammed bin Salman to continue most of the same Saudi foreign policy goals that he has been responsible for pursuing.
The recent changes internally and with respect to Saudi foreign policy have largely had Mohammed bin Salman's influence in it, and therefore I don't expect to see any real changes with respect to Saudi foreign policy.
He argues that analysts in the Gulf believe Saudi Arabia will continue to take a hardline stance on Iran's aggressive posture in the region, especially in meddling in Arab affairs in Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere. Hilal Kashan, who teaches political science at the American University of Beirut, calls the naming of Mohammed bin Salman to be crown prince a palace coup, stressing that it marks not just the continuation of the status quo, but an escalation in Saudi regional policies. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello. I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. A new single has been released by a London-based singer whose family hails from Eastern Europe. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London tells me all about it.
Our subject is a beautiful young Albanian singer who has grown up in London, but family heritage is from Kosovo and Albania. Her name is Dua Lipa, And people will know her probably easiest from the big hit that she had in the last year, Scared to Be Lonely, which is a song that was produced and created by Martin Garrix with Dua Lipa. But after a long 2-year wait, her debut self-titled album finally came out at the beginning of June, and she's got a new single, and we're going to listen to the new single from Dua Lipa right now called Lost in Your Light.
Well, that's kind of an interesting background she's got, being Albanian but living in London.
Yeah, there hasn't been a lot of singers who come from that part of the world. Rita Ora, however, has a history from Kosovo. But Dua Lipa's the new kid in town, although she's not really new. She's kind of released a whole bunch of music over the course of 2 years, which has been a long wait. And I know you're going to ask me why the wait, and my answer will be, I don't know. It's just taken that long. So she's released a number of singles from the album, but she said she feels great. She just can't believe that finally her album has been released. And so far, the music's been well received. She opened up at the BBC One big weekend concert that they just hosted there in London recently. And she's on a fast track to doing well. I mean, as I mentioned, Scared to Be Lonely made it to the top 10 on the Billboard charts. So now she's got the new song, and hopefully it will do just as well for her. And the new song features Miguel, who's another very popular singer. So Dua Lipa with Miguel's help and Lost in Your Light.
Is she touring?
As a matter of fact, she is. But she's not doing a headline tour yet, but she's kind of doing little performances along the way, a few festivals. A lot of the artists are doing festivals. It gives them a chance to try out some new material, see what the crowd's reaction will be. And then she is planning a full-blown tour now that her new album has finally been released.
Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings. Well, the music of Dua Lipa brings an end to our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Since the mid-1990s, when limited self-rule was established in the West Bank and Gaza, the United States has contributed more than $5 billion in economic and non-lethal security assistance to the Palestinians. Under President Donald Trump, that assistance is slated to continue. The goal of such assistance is to help meet the humanitarian needs of the Palestinian people and foster the conditions of stability and prosperity that could lead to a lasting peace between Israelis and Palestinians. But as Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has made clear, the United States is looking for a change in the long-standing policy of the Palestinian Authority to make payments to the families of terrorists killed or wounded in carrying out violent attacks against Israelis. In testimony before Congress, Mr. Tillerson said both he and President Trump raised the issue with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas during their May visit to Bethlehem. Although the Palestinian Authority announced last month that it was stopping payments to some Hamas-affiliated prisoners, that move fails to address the scope of U.S. concerns over the practice of rewarding terrorists and murderers, which has continued. As President Trump said, standing in Bethlehem next to President Abbas, "Peace can never take root in an environment where violence is tolerated, funded, or rewarded. We must be resolute in condemning such acts in a single, unified voice."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.